One can only appreciate the sea change brought about in 1965 if one understands what happened in 665, in 965, and in 1265. This is one of the fundamental points that I'm going to want to convey in the course of this lecture series. What is not necessarily what was. We could only understand the is if we understand the was. The contemporary world, with all of its nuance and complexity, can only be appreciated if one is aware of important aspects of the medieval world. You expelled us, we're back, and we're still here. Jews lived in Spain under Islamic rule from the beginning of the 8th century, when the Muslims conquered Spain from the Christians. Some three centuries later, in the middle of the 11th century, the Christians began reconquering the land, a process known technically as the Reconquest or Reconquista. The Muslims, when they came to capture Spain, they were pushing from south up. They came through North Africa and invaded Spain and moved south to north. But now the Christians, beginning in the 11th century, began to reverse the direction, and they began to push from north to south. And so on Spanish soil is where the Crusades actually took place in this context. Christendom and Islam confront one another in the country of Spain. I remember a number of years ago flying from Granada, which is the southernmost part of Spain, we'll see that in a moment, to Barcelona, which is in the northeastern part of Spain. And I was looking out the window and I imagined on the land that I was seeing all of these armies pushing back and forth against one another. It was all here. Crusades took place here in Spanish soil. The Reconquest concluded only in January of 1492, when the Christians, under the leadership and authority of Ferdinand and Isabella, we'll come back to them in a moment, succeeded in removing the last stronghold of Muslim presence in Spain, in the southernmost kingdom of Granada. They pushed and they pushed and they pushed, and it was only in 1492 the Muslims were limited to this tiny little area, and it was then that they were conquered. It is, in fact, before I get too far into this presentation, it's a misnomer to speak at this point of a country called, quote, Spain. Until the end of the 15th century, there were five separate countries in the Iberian Peninsula: Aragon to the east, each one with its own king and queen and ruling authority. Aragon to the east, bordering on the Mediterranean. Castile was in the middle. Portugal was on the west, bordering on the Atlantic. Navarre north in the middle. And Granada to the south, five separate countries. Only later do they become united. Jews had always been much more involved in Muslim culture than they were in Christian culture. Hebrew and Arabic were connected. They were connected as cognate languages. We saw already one example earlier, Dar al-Harb, harb meaning sword in Arabic, cherev, sword in Hebrew. Even just take the name of God. The name of God in Arabic, transliterated A-L-L-A-H. The name of God in Hebrew, transliterated E-L-O-H-I-M. They sound very much like one another. So there's a lot of linguistic connections between these two languages, but they were connected not just that way, but also because Arabic, like Hebrew, served both religious as well as secular purposes. These were the languages of each other's respective holy scripture, the Hebrew Bible for the Jews, the Quran for the Muslims, And also, they were both languages of secular love and war poetry. Contrast this to Latin, which was the language of European Christendom, that was used almost exclusively in a religious context. And therefore, it was not only alien, but it was distasteful. It was off-putting for Jews. It was too closely tied to the church and to Christianity. And so, general observation, in Muslim Spain, Jews felt very much in sync with the surrounding culture. In Christian Spain, Jews felt very much alienated from the surrounding culture. As the reconquest proceeds from north to south, Christians need the Jews to administer the cities that were more and more coming under their jurisdiction. And not unlike the situation that pertained a few centuries earlier when the Muslims took control, they needed the Jews to help them govern what they conquered. The Jews were skilled in commerce, government service, they were able to advance money, they were desirable allies to the Christians as the Christians pushed southward. Many Jewish communities were given the right to govern themselves. They had their own court system, and as a sign of their unusual high status, they were the only Jewry, Spanish Jewry, were the only Jewry in Europe given the power to exercise capital punishment. In addition, Spanish Jewry, and again I'm using the word Spanish incorrectly, Spanish Jewry developed a courtier class that served in the royal court to represent Jewish interests and enjoyed very close relationships with the ruling authorities. Jews recognized very early in their experience of exile that only by disassociating themselves with the endless shifting mercies of local officials, and only by linking themselves to strong centralized authorities in their various respective countries, could they ensure their self-preservation and their survival. You can't ultimately really trust the local authorities. They're not really that strong anyway. And in addition, they change. You depend on this one, 7 minutes later somebody else comes. It's not a way to ensure your survival and your safety and your freedom. The royal authority is the way to go. This phenomenon, my teacher, Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi, called, quote, the royal alliance. Nowhere was it more prominent than it was in Spain. The Jews link themselves to royal authorities, and there's a whole class of Jews that develops to maintain and to help along with that relationship. But there were dangers in this arrangement, as you could understand. In cases of popular uprisings against the king, the Jews were victims. They suffered by association. We'll talk about that in my next lecture when I focus on Polish Jewry in the 17th century. Even more ominously, if the royal authorities no longer saw that it was in their best interest to maintain a relationship with the Jews would be left with no protection whatsoever. In the 14th century, the situation of the Jews begins to significantly deteriorate in Christian Spain. There were economic challenges, growing political instability, and with them came a tide of anti-Jewish legislation and increasing Jew hatred. Religious fanaticism was mounting, and matters came to a head in the year 1391, when widespread anti-Jewish violence erupted with a passion, with a ferocity, both in Castile and in Aragon, two separate countries. Thousands of Jews were killed, and thousands more were forcibly converted to Christianity. And by the second decade of the next, of the 15th century, crushed and defeated and demoralized, many Jews just gave up and voluntarily converted to Christianity. They bought into the argument of historical empiricism. At first, these converts, called conversos, were welcomed into Christian society. Converts were always hitherto welcomed into Christian society. They became Christian officials, they married into the nobility, but by the end of the century, the Christians had a problem. So many Jews had converted to Christianity, whether forcibly or voluntarily, that the church simply could not assimilate them into Christian society. And they were forced to maintain a separate identity within Spanish Christendom, and they were referred to as new Christians. There were simply too many to integrate comfortably into Christian culture. In 1449, the church introduced the concept, popularized some 500 years later by the Nazis, called limpieza de sangre, which means purity of blood, aimed at discriminating against this vast number of newcomers to Christianity. One needed to be an old Christian. One needed to be a Christian whose blood was pure in order to achieve positions of prominence within the church. By this time, we're now the middle of the 15th century, large numbers of conversos, or new Christians, were living side by side with professing Jews who survived the massacres, who did not convert, and who insisted upon continuing to maintain their Jewish identities. When Jews converted to Christianity, they didn't move out into another neighborhood. They lived where they lived, and they lived side by side, cousin next to cousin, sister next to sister, same street, same neighborhood, maybe even same house, as they always lived. And the Spanish church authorities began to be afraid, with good reason, that the Jewish neighbors and family members of those who converted would influence them to come back. Please, you think your name is Juan, your name is Shlomo. Passover is coming, you remember Bubby, you remember our grandmother. Come, just come. We love each other, we're in the same family. Old time's sake, come. Oh, this holiday, this Friday night, you remember Friday night we used to have something very special, come. And they were living together in the same places, and they shared a common heritage. And we have evidence that those who remained Jews started to have an influence on those who left Judaism. And the church was really concerned about this, and they sought strategies to separate these two groups. In 1480, they began to segregate the Jewish community from the converso community, required the Jews to wear red badges. In 1481, they instituted the Inquisition, whose responsibility it was to ensure that new Christians not revert back to Judaism. It's important to realize that the Inquisition never went against those who Catholic Christian authorities thought were Jews. It only went against those who had converted to Christianity, which according to Christian tradition, if you convert to Christianity, once you're a Christian, you're a Christian, you can't revert back or convert to any other religion, then you would be open to the challenges of the Inquisition. To fast forward for a second, after 1492, any Jew who remained in Spain was announcing, I am now a Christian. And so the Inquisition went after them. They never went after professing Jews when there were allowed to be professing Jews on Spanish soil. But none of these moves helped at all. None of them were successful. Not segregation, not the badge, even the Inquisition. And the Crown realized, and the Church realized, Crown and Church together, that a more dramatic step would be necessary. Now, a few decades earlier, in 1469, Ferdinand, who was the king of Aragon, married Isabella, who was the queen of Castile. And 10 years later, in 1479, the marriage became a merger. Castile and Aragon merge, and now, for the first time, we have a country called Spain. In order to consolidate their power and to strengthen their now common identity, both of them, now a team, one country, turned their attention to those groups who were the other, quote, the other, in the Iberian Peninsula. They started with the Muslims, and they conquered Granada, which was the last outpost, as I mentioned earlier, of Islam on the Iberian Peninsula in January of 1492. No sooner were they done with the Muslims, they turned their attention to the Jews. Still in Granada, having just completed the battle against the Muslims there, Ferdinand and Isabella signed an edict of expulsion, requiring all Jews to leave Spain on March 31st, 1492. That's when it was signed. And all Jews needed to leave Spain, according to the statement of the edict, within 3 months. The edict explicitly stated the reason why it was promulgated, and I quote, "Because we were informed that in these our kingdoms," Castile and Aragon, now Spain, "there were some bad Christians who Judaized and apostatized from our holy Catholic faith, this being chiefly caused by the communication of the Jews with the Christians." The Christians they're talking about here, the bad Christians who Judaized and apostatized from our holy Catholic faith, are those who originally started as Jews, converted to Christianity. Once you're a Christian, you're a Christian. And now, if you want to move to another religion, even if it's the religion that you originally started with, you're a bad Christian. This is not acceptable. We can't allow Christians who we consider to be Christians to be anything other than Christians. The edict was signed in the Hall of the Ambassadors in the Alhambra Palace in Granada, which remains till this day an absolutely magnificent Moorish structure. I have been in that room, the Hall of the Ambassadors in the Alhambra Palace, more than once, leading groups of American Jews on tours, Jewish history tours of Europe. And just like I mentioned to you earlier about the Hotel de Ville, the square in front of the City Hall in Paris, in that room, I lead my group in singing, "The Jewish people still lives, Am Yisrael Chai." Every single time the guards get very nervous. The 30, 40 Jews were singing, and it's supposed to be solemn, and we finish our singing. And it's a statement, and it's an important statement. Jews were discriminated against, Jews were expelled, Jews were persecuted, and Jews suffered. But thank God Jews are still alive. You expelled us, we're back, and we're still here. It took a month for the edict to take effect. It took effect at the end of April. There were a lot of efforts on the part of those who were courtiers in the royal court to try to stave off the edict of expulsion. It didn't work. It was postponed for a month. It took effect at the end of April. 3 months, May, June, July. And so by the last day of July of 1492, very close to the ninth day of the Hebrew month of Av, Tisha B'Av, a most sad day in the Jewish calendar set aside to remember the destructions of both the first and the second temple. Is a coincidence, or maybe not a coincidence. Any Jew who wanted to publicly profess her or his religious tradition as a Jew had to leave. Anyone who remained behind was understood to have made the decision to become a Christian. In the words of the prominent 20th century Jewish historian Yitzhak Baer, and I quote, "On the anniversary of the destruction of the temple, all the Jews of Spain were either wandering outside its borders on land and sea, or were confined in the dungeons of the Inquisition and bound by the fetters of an alien faith which had been forced upon them." This was not the first expulsion of Jews from a country in Europe. I mentioned earlier, Jews had already been expelled from England in 1290. 1306, they were expelled from France after being readmitted, finally expelled in 1394. 1421, they're expelled from Austria and throughout the 15th century from various Germanic principalities. Augsburg, Bavaria, Franconia, there was also no such thing as Germany yet at that time. It was broken up into different areas. The Jews are getting expelled, and now in 1492, they were expelled from Spain. We don't know how many Jews left Spain. There are no reliable statistics. It's impossible so many years ago to have even semi-accurate or close to accurate numbers, even remotely resembling reliable statistics. The current scholarly consensus is that there were about 100,000 Jews in Spain at the time of the expulsion, and the current scholarly consensus, the assumption is half and half. Half stayed and half left. But really, we have really no idea at all. The expulsion of the Jews from Spain was the most traumatic of all the expulsions of Jews from any European country, and this for a number of reasons. First of all, it was the largest expulsion. Roughly 3,000 Jews were expelled from England in 1290. 2 centuries later, roughly 50,000 Jews are expelled from Spain, the largest ever, more than any other geographic area anywhere. Second of all, there's a psychological dimension here. Spanish Jews always considered themselves to be deeply Spanish. They were Spanish Jews in that order. They were first Spanish, and then they were Jews. Read German Jews in the 1930s, read American Jews in the 20th and 21st centuries. The sense of rootedness, this is our country. We belong here like anyone else, and we've reached prominence here, maybe more than many others. Read Germany, read America. And therefore, their expulsion was far more traumatic than any other. In other countries, the Jews didn't feel so rooted, so they were expelled. I mean, it's a terrible thing, but here, us, Spanish Jews, us, you're expelling us? It's inconceivable. And finally, this was the culminating expulsion. I already mentioned that Jews were expelled from many other West European countries. This was the last one. And so by the time we come to the end of the 15th century, Western Europe was, to borrow a term from the 20th century, Western Europe was Judenrein. We're done. No more Jews. No more publicly professing Jews are living in Western Europe. The options open to the Jews when they were expelled from Spain were severely limited. Other countries, as I just mentioned, had long ago expelled their Jews. Holland and southern Italy were under Spanish domination, so that was not going to be an option for them. The easiest thing for them to do was to spill over into the borders of the two other still existing countries in the Iberian Peninsula, Portugal to the west and Navarre to the north. So they're still within the Iberian Peninsula. It makes the most sense. It's the closest place to go to get out of Spain. Initially, between a third and a half, and again, we don't really know numbers for sure, went to Portugal, and a smaller number went to Navarre. But they faced great opposition in Navarre for two reasons. Number one, the Navarrese community also didn't love Jews. Their age-old anti-Jewish religious intolerance that was prevalent in Navarre. They're not opening their arms to these Jews. These Jews killed Jesus. These Jews, we don't want these Jews. And second of all, there was an additional consideration. They had a fear of angering Ferdinand and Isabella, who just expelled the Jews. Letting the Jews in, they were afraid, would simply arouse the ire of a much more prominent and powerful kingdom, Spanish monarchs, who just expelled the Jews. But in any case, the stay of the Jews in both of these countries, in Portugal and in Navarre, was limited. By the end of the century, by the end of the 15th century, Portugal forcibly converted its Jews, and Navarre expelled its Jews. By the middle of the 16th century, the Sephardic diaspora becomes rooted around the entire Mediterranean basin, North Africa, Palestine, Syria, Turkey, the Balkans, the area that is known as the Ottoman Empire. And so at this moment, by the time we come to the middle of the 16th century, Ashkenazi Jews moved eastward into Poland, more on that in the next lecture. Sephardi Jews are moving eastward into the Ottoman Empire. I want now to direct our attention to the impact of the Spanish expulsion. I've spoken a little bit about Jewish life in 13th and 14th and 15th centuries. I've spoken about the expulsion in 1492, and now I want to bring the story into the 16th century, the impact of this monumental, catastrophic expulsion. Number one, it raised very serious theological questions. And I would say not unlike many that were raised in the wake of the Holocaust in the 20th century. Why did God do this to us? They believed in God. They believed that God ran the world. How could God do this? How could God have such a powerful and prominent Jewry brought to such a humiliating and ignominious end? Obviously, in the case of the Shoah or the Holocaust, it's light years more challenging. But the similar kinds of questions were raised now as well. How could this be? Where is God? We have a relationship with God. We're the greatest of the great. How could this happen to us? The initial reaction of human beings to any catastrophe that they experience is to search for and to apply age-old established explanations or rationales or paradigms for tragedy, to grasp at what you know. The theological justification that was advanced in ancient times for the destruction of both temples in Jerusalem was, it was our fault. God is great. God only does just things. If God is doing this, it must be because we deserved it. Mipnei chata'enu galinu me'artzainu. It's because of our sins that we were expelled from our land. And so first, Spanish Jewry figures out and comes to the conclusion that this happened to them because they deserved this to happen to them, because they sinned. And an entire moralistic literature is produced in the 16th century, blaming the Jews for an array of sins that must be is what accounted for this punishment of the expulsion. Only terrible sins could bring forth such a terrible punishment. So what were the sins? They went searching for sins. Some of them suggested too much hubris. They were too proud of their achievements. They flaunted their wealth. They were too comfortable. They forgot that they were living in exile. They were too rooted in Spain. They weren't Jewishly connected enough. They were too assimilated. Many moralists also railed against the deleterious effects of the study of philosophy, especially among the aristocratic courtier class. They felt that studying philosophy and focusing on philosophy resulted in religious and moral laxity. You're not good Jews. You're not even moral. All kinds of inappropriate behavior is going on. Yeah, now I get it. Now I understand. It's hard for me, and I'm upset, and I'm angry, and I'm struggling. But, you know, it's not that far off that this should have happened to us. And so one challenge and one reaction was theological. Some have suggested that another reaction to the expulsion was a writing of codes, particularly the code entitled the Shulchan Aruch, that was composed, I referred to Rabbi Joseph Caro before, was composed in the 1560s. Rabbi Caro himself was in exile from Spain as a very little boy. The late Professor R.J. Z. Werblowski, a prominent Israeli historian, wrote the following in the introduction to his biography of Rabbi Caro. He writes that Rabbi Caro wrote this code now, quote, "In the atmosphere of chaos and disintegration that prevailed after the expulsion from Spain, and in the profound conviction that some measure of uniformity and order was indispensable if Israel was to be ready for the advent of the Redeemer." Werblowski suggested that the atmosphere of upheaval and anarchy and chaos brought about by the expulsion, you can only imagine. Jews have been living for 1,000 years in a particular place and they're giving 3 months to get out and everybody's panicking. Chaos, anarchy, upheaval. His suggestion is that there was a real concern that there would be an utter disintegration of any semblance of communal cohesion and any tradition passed on from parent to child, from generation to generation would be totally obliterated, would be exploded. And therefore there was a great fear that the law and the traditions would be forgotten. This would be a major disaster for anyone for whom Jewish observance was central. And therefore, suggested Werblowski, that it was deemed important that everything should be written down so that we should know it, we should record it, and we should remember it. Others argued that the writing of codes had a different way of unfolding, that sometimes there was a code, and sometimes there was a commentary, and sometimes there was a code, and sometimes there was a commentary, and don't necessarily see it, this particular work, as others in the context of response to persecution. But Werblowski felt that that, in fact, was a legitimate way of perceiving this whole enterprise of code writing, particularly the Shulchan Aruch. Third, another area where the impact of the Spanish expulsion was felt was in the writing of history. And here again, I acknowledge the work of my teacher, Professor Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi. I studied with him at Harvard. He went on to be a professor at Columbia for many, many years. Yerushalmi pointed out in a celebrated book entitled Zachor, subtitled Jewish History and Jewish Memory, that throughout the Middle Ages, Jews contributed to virtually every single genre of intellectual creativity. Poetry, philosophy, exegesis, commentary, responsa, mysticism, with the exception of history. Jews wrote a lot, but Jews did not write history. But now, chapter 3 of Zachor, everything changes. In the century after the Spanish expulsion, shows Yerushalmi, Jews produced a large, sustained corpus of historical writing for the first time, designed to try to understand what happened. How do we place this event in the context of the larger Jewish historical tradition? 10 major works of Jewish historical writing were written now. 5 were written either by exiles themselves from the Iberian Peninsula or their descendants. In the words of Yerushalmi, and I quote, "The primary stimulus to the rise of Jewish historiography in the 16th century was the great catastrophe that had put an abrupt end to open Jewish life in the Iberian Peninsula at the end of the 15th. For the first time since antiquity, we encounter a ramified Jewish historiographical response to a major historical event." The fourth reaction to or impact of the Spanish expulsion is messianism. It has been suggested that there was an upsurge of messianism during this time directly linked to the trauma of the Spanish expulsion. In times of stress, and this makes sense, messianic antennae always begin to quiver. People are looking around. It's horrible. How am I going to survive? How am I going to get out of here? How am I going to be able to continue? What will my future be? Must be, oh, the Messiah is going to come. The Messiah is going to save me. The Messiah will usher in an entirely different world, and I will be safe. I'm going to focus more on messianism and the implication of messianism in my 9th lecture. The final impact of the Spanish expulsion that I want to address is the evolution of the Sephardi diaspora. Already in the aftermath of the 1391 persecutions that I mentioned a moment ago in Castile and Aragon, many Jews already then left the Iberian Peninsula and settled in the Balkans, North Africa, Turkey, and elsewhere. The result of this earlier, smaller immigration was very significant. Because of it, when the bulk of those who were exiled from Spain arrived in these very same areas in the Ottoman Empire, they found an already existing nucleus of Sephardi communities that had already been established there from 100 years before. But Sephardi Jews did not find a welcome mat rolled out for them when they arrived. This time, the challenge didn't come from the outside. You remember in Navarre, the Navarrese authorities didn't want the Jews to come. This time, it came from the inside. It came from their co-religionists themselves from within the Jewish community. The already existing Jewish communities in these places were not really strong and solid and firm. They were very unhappy with this onslaught, this stampede of Jews, who they feared would severely tax their already strained, limited communal resources. And we arrive here at another important historical law. Quote, Ahavat Yisrael, loving other Jews, is directly proportional to distance. And I want to say that again. Loving other Jews is directly proportional to distance. Namely, the further they are from me, the more I am going to love them. From a distance, I care about them, I worry about them, I pray for them, I'm concerned about them. But when they start moving in to my backyard, NIMBY syndrome, I just can't do it. I mean, they're sweet, I love them, but do me a favor, you know, go somewhere else. I can't handle it. I have limited resources, and they're going to be taxed beyond comprehension, and we're simply not going to be able to help you, to assimilate you. And so they don't. The Spanish Jews who arrive are not welcome with open arms, and we're going to do everything that we can for you. This is a challenge that Jewish communities, and I would imagine all communities, face when refugees move into a community. And there's tension, and there was a lot of tension. We have evidence of a lot of tension between the newly arriving Spanish immigrants in large numbers and those who had arrived there before from the same cities, the same towns, 100 years earlier after 1391. But the fact is that the newly arrived Spanish communities overpowered and steamrolled over those who had been living there before. With their numbers, with their pride, with their strong sense of self, they pretty much ran roughshod over the local communities that they encountered when they arrived. Their customs and their practices were the ones that prevailed and became dominant. In this lecture, I focused on the experience of Sephardi Jews during their last years in the Iberian Peninsula through the expulsion and into the 16th century. In my next lecture, I want to turn my attention to the experience of Ashkenazi Jews as they moved from northwestern Europe to eastern Europe, where they created a most vibrant and robust community by the 16th century. The impact of these massacres was enormous. Polish Jewry made Herculean efforts to try to recreate their community, some semblance of community, but they sensed that a great era had irrevocably come to an end.